her here with us. First, we have the Vilas County Teen Court. Would the Vilas County Teen Court please stand? Thank you. We're delighted that you're with us today. I think that you are the first teen court as a group who has come to watch our proceedings. And are you prosecutors, defense counsel, or judges on the teen court, or all of the above? All of the above. Well, thank you very much. You of course, are running what comparable to a trial court rather than an appellate court. And we also have with us the Believers in Christ Christian Academy. Would those students please stand? We're delighted to welcome you here today. Would you please be seated? These students are with us with a national award-winning program called Court with Class, which is sponsored by the State Bar and by the Supreme Court. And we invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. The students are sent materials about their case that they are about to hear. And the work that is done on the case, of course, is always left to the particular high school group. And as part of that Court with Class program, after this case, the students will meet with a justice of this court. And the justice will discuss the procedures that the court uses, but not the substance of the particular case that we hear. And today, that noon presentation will be made by Justice Bradley. Everyone is invited to stay for that discussion with Justice Bradley, not only the students, but any other guests in the courtroom today. So let me now introduce the court to you, and I'll start with Justice Bradley, who is the justice with whom you're going to meet, and she sits to my immediate left. Seated to her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and to my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I will now call our second case for today, which is 01-3093 CR State v. And is it Nadahor?
Yes.
Okay. And counsel for Mr. Nadahor is Philip Bream of Janesville, representing the defendant here. Counsel? I'd suggest you put it farther, well, and farther up on your lapel. Thank you, counsel.
It is an honor to be here today. I, again, am Philip Brahm, and I'm a sole practitioner from Janesville. I represent Victor Nadahor in this case. He is the defendant appellant petitioner. He is in the process of serving a five-year term of initial confinement handed down in this case by Judge Schrader. He is currently located at Appleton, Minnesota. He's placed out of state. There are two issues to discuss today in this case. I'm going to move to the second issue first. I feel this is probably the defense's strongest argument. Whether there should be a presumption of vindictiveness in this case.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but do we have to decide both issues? Or if we decide one of these issues, is that adequate?
I believe that one or the other will provide relief to my client, and yes, if one issue is decided in his favor, that would be dispositive.
Thank you.
I want to start by saying that the result in this case is not fair, just, or equitable. I think that it encourages the state to make end runs around plea agreements, and ultimately it serves to create a massive chilling effect on a defendant's right to appeal questionable conduct by the state. The court is familiar with the facts. I want to just briefly run down those facts because I think it's important. My client was operating while intoxicated. He caused great bodily harm to an individual while he was operating his motor vehicle. He was charged in Kenosha County. He reached a plea agreement with the state where the state essentially said they would argue for jail time and probation on the offense. At sentencing before Judge Kluka, the state ultimately cheats. They argue something they shouldn't argue. They essentially told the court the plea agreement was invalid. The plea agreement is then disregarded by Judge Kluka. My client gets 3 years in prison and 5 years extended supervision. Now there my client sat. Where was he to go from there? Was he to enforce his right to have the state act appropriately at sentencing? Was he to take his medicine, accept the fact that sometimes even assistant district attorneys don't play fair in cases? If the state's position is adopted, defendants like Mr. Naderhor will not have redress. Appeals will be too risky. Essentially, they'll face a Hobson's choice. They will just have to accept the unfairness or risk even getting a worse sentence, which is what happened in this case.
Counsel, in other words, your idea of what should happen is that you can never get, you have, it always has to be 3 years or less. In other words, whatever he got, it has to be less. There never can be, for whatever reason, an increased sentence. Is that what, that's basically your argument? Right?
No, I would not say that it's that broad. I don't think Pierce is that broad, and I will discuss how Pierce has been limited, but I think the core decision in Pierce is applicable in this case, and I think that it should act to limit the maximum sentence my client faced at 3 years initial confinement and 5 years of extended supervision. I think that my position is sounder from a policy standpoint than the state's position. And I think it's consistent with the pronouncements of the United States Supreme Court. The Pierce case, obviously, and the Church case from this state should guide the court in reaching its decision today. Pierce, obviously, is the heart of my argument. It holds that a trial court cannot punish a defendant more harshly at resentencing after a successful appeal simply because the defendant appealed. The more important language from that case, which I will speak of frequently, is that a trial court cannot increase a sentence upon reconviction after a successful appeal absent new objective information concerning identifiable conduct on the part of the defendant. Pierce has been clarified by some later United States Supreme Court cases. However, I think in relevant part, that particular holding remains good law.
Counsel, my read of the Wassman case, one of the cases that's the Pierce progeny, suggests to me that it is broader than that. That is, absent identifiable conduct or events. Do you disagree that the Pierce language that you read has been broadened by subsequent cases?
Yes, I agree with you that that the Wassman case does broaden that determination. But I don't agree that the Wassman case would somehow diminish the applicability of Pierce in this particular case.
Why isn't this an event, this information regarding the condition of the victim?
I would take the position that it's just too attenuated from the defendant's conduct, which may occur after the time of his original sentencing. I take the position that the focus should be on what the defendant has done between sentencing and resentencing. And I acknowledge what Wassman says. I think in Wassman, the intervening fact was a criminal conviction. And before the criminal conviction, the trial court couldn't use it against the defendant. After the criminal conviction, the trial court could use it against the defendant. And I think that gets to be proof that that there really is new information that goes to the defendant's behavior.
This is a little different slant to the question I just asked, but in the back of my mind, of course, is the importance of victims' rights, constitutional amendment regarding victims' rights. If the victim's condition and what occurred to the victim and the victim's ability to be present at the original sentencing, and certainly all those rights are spelled out for us, if that original sentencing is considered invalid, why doesn't a victim have the same victim's rights that we see in the original sentencing applicable in the resentencing? We're talking in part here about the defendant's rights and the state's rights, and I realize the paramount importance of the defendant's rights, but the victim still does have rights too. So why can't the victim exercise the victim's rights at resentencing?
I think that the victim should be able to do that, and the victim did do so in this case. That gets to be another facet of my argument to talk about whether or not the old information versus the new information was sufficient enough to justify the upward revision of the sentence, assuming that Pierce applies. And, I think that the victim had a right to give her version of events, but I think if you look at what she said closely, there really wasn't a lot of difference between what information existed at the time of sentencing and what information existed at the time of resentencing. I believe at the time of sentencing there was a discussion of $22,000 to $30,000 in medical bills, and they were ongoing with at least one more surgery to occur. When this case got to Judge Schrader, the medical bills had gone up to $70,000, and there was the possibility of another surgery coming in the future.
So they more than doubled.
They did more than double. But I think the bottom line is that ultimately the end result didn't change. The victim was severely affected financially by this incident. And I think it's a fairly subtle difference to talk about $30,000 in ongoing and $70,000 and increasing. And it's my position that really gets to be attenuated from the focus which should be on the defendant's conduct, what he did when he committed this crime.
Counselor, because the first sentencing was totally vacated, shouldn't, and we have a different judge, we don't have the same judge, why shouldn't we look at this as we would if this were the first sentencing and the judge considered exactly the same information?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are a number of reasons why that should not occur in this case. A couple of the cases that were discussed by both the defense and the state kind of address that particular issue. Chaffin versus Stinchcomb is one, Alabama versus Smith, Texas versus McCullough, and I believe there's Colton, the Kentucky case. These cases, none of them actually address the issue that we're facing here. Some of them talk about some situations that are somewhat similar, and by analogy, the state suggests that because it's a different judge, the first result should be completely ignored. I would take the position that the focus should be on the reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness at resentencing. And there's at least two cases which indicate that that is what the focus should be. One of them is the United States versus Goodwin case, and the other one would be the Alabama versus Smith case. The Chaffin case discusses whether there's a de minimis risk, which I would take the position is very similar. I would argue that there were five circumstances in this case which would suggest that there was a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness on the part of Judge Schrader. First, it's important to point out that Judge Schrader did not give my client the resentencing. Judge Kloka did. This case is somewhat different than the McCullough case, which is cited in our briefs. In the McCullough case, I hope I got these facts right, the jury gave a defendant 25 years in prison. The judge gives the defendant a new trial because the prosecutor did something improper during the trial. So the judge vacates that first sentence, gives the defendant a new trial. The judge the defendant is convicted again, and this time the judge gave the defendant 50 years. In that particular case, the judge heard some more negative information about the defendant. In fact, in that case, he heard that, or she heard, I believe it was, that the defendant had actually committed the crime in that case. But I think the important thing to look at with regard to McCullough is that the judge who granted the relief imposed the harsher sentence later. So I think the fact that the judge gave the defendant a new trial is almost a per se indication that the judge was going to treat the defendant fairly down the line. And it's hard to suggest under those circumstances that somehow the trial judge has an axe to grind with the defendant. If the trial judge had an axe to grind with the defendant, why would the judge give the defendant a new trial in the first place?
How does that create imputed vindictiveness to the new judge?
In this particular case?
You're arguing that had the case been retained by Judge Kluka, everything would have been fine, but it wasn't. It was sent to a new judge. So what is the argument that there was a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness on the part of the new judge who had nothing to do with the case before?
Well, there's a number of things that I would point to. There was five things that I was going to list, and I'll try to go through some of the other reasons why I think that it makes a difference in this case.
Right. That first one has nothing to do with the new judge and everything to do with the old judge. So take that off the table.
Okay. The second thing I would point to, that unlike the Colton case out of Kentucky where there was two different courts that were not equally situated, in this case, Judge Schrader and Judge Kluka were and are equals. They were both circuit court judges from Kenosha County. Kenosha County has only seven judges, is my understanding. So you have here two trial judges who would tend to work together and who would, from time to time, be called upon to preside over each other's retrials in the event there got to be an issue like this. And a judge in Judge Schrader's situation, this second new judge, may want to discourage defendants from creating more work for himself by giving a harsher sentence to send out a message that maybe you don't want to appeal and maybe you don't want to create more work for me. That concern was discussed in the Floyd case, which is a Fifth Circuit case. In that particular case, the court supported the Pierce holding and discussed the apprehension that a defendant may have in appealing, knowing about the stake a second judge may have in the outcome of the appeal.
So, counsel, under your theory or your second point, this case should have been sent when you had a new trial. You'd have to bring in a non-Kenosha judge, right? You have seven judges in Kenosha County, and they work together. And under your explanation, because they work together, they would be apt to give a longer sentence. So you would need to bring in a judge from some other area.
Well, that is certainly something that you could do to address the issue of the reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness.
But the point is that there's no judge in Kenosha County, whether it's Judge Schrader or some other judge, that would not fall under that same concern, right?
Right. And I'm certainly not suggesting that that's all you look at. If that exists, you have to apply the Pierce presumption.
So if you're in Milwaukee County, you'd have to get, because they're in the same county and they work together. I mean, since I served in a one-judge county, I can see you could bring somebody in, but most counties or many have more than one judge. So you're saying that if this happens in any multiple-judge area, that I'm talking about county, then you'd have to go outside.
No, I would not go so far as to say that, but I think
why not? Because that's your argument. I mean, is it just Kenosha County?
No, but I think that you would look at how big the county is. That's one of the factors that you would look at in one of the factors you should look at in determining whether or not there was a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness. But I certainly will not stand up here and say, because the two judges were from the same county, there is vindictiveness for sure. I just won't say that. I think there are other things, though, that apply. And basically, my argument is that these number of factors are all relevant to the issue of whether or not the presumption of vindictiveness should apply. And I think when you add them all up, it makes a difference in this case. Another thing that I think was important factually in this case is Judge Schrader knew what the prior result had been in this case. And I think that fact is important in the analysis when you look at the Chaffin case and, to a lesser extent, the Colton case. In this particular case, Judge Schrader said he reviewed the record. Presumably, he knew what the sentence structure was that was handed down by Judge Klucka. And that said, there gets to be a concern at that point that Judge Schrader may have used the prior sentence as a benchmark or a minimum sentence structure. And I think when you look at what Judge Schrader said at resentencing, there is at least some support for that position. Judge Schrader essentially said at resentencing, this case is in a much, well, not verbatim, but he said it essentially, this case is much more serious now than it was before Judge Klucka. And my question would be, why would Judge Schrader bother saying that if it was not his intent to somehow use Judge Klucka's prior sentence somehow as a tool to try to determine what the appropriate sentence should have been in this case? And I think he said something along the lines that there's a monstrous increase in the severity of this offense based on these two certain facts. So I think he sent a message. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but he sent a message that the sentence has to be harsher than what Judge Klucka handed down. There is discussion in the case law regarding separate facts which are going to be relevant to the issue. And one of the considerations is whether or not the second judge is being asked to do again what has already been done correctly the first time. And I think there is some of that in working in this particular case. It's important to recognize that the issue in this case essentially was, the first time around, the defendant appears before Judge Klucka for sentencing, and the state basically says, this is the agreement, but you know what, we found out about two more convictions regarding alcohol-related operation of a motor vehicle, but still follow the agreement. It's clear that the judge did not follow the agreement, and it's clear that Judge Klucka took into consideration those other two convictions. And the reality of the matter is the judge should have been allowed to take into consideration that other information. There certainly is no precedent for the state and the defense to try to hide such information from the second judge. Or in this case, it would have been Judge Klucka. So essentially then at that point, Judge Kluka says, yes, there's a mistake, and then Judge Schrader picks up the file, and Judge Schrader presumably knew what the issue was here, and certainly Judge Schrader could have determined that, hey, you know, it was done right the first time, and I'm being asked to do it all over again a second time. And again, I think that is a consideration that is relevant to the issue of whether or not Pierce should apply in this case. And there's one other fact that I want to bring up that I think is interesting in this case, and I think that it is, too, something that should be factored into the question of whether or not the Pierce presumption should apply. In this particular case, there was a failed substitution effort made by my client's trial counsel in attempting to remove Judge Schrader from the case. It's my understanding that what happened is that the request for substitution came late. Judge Schrader rightfully determined that the substitution should not be granted, and the case remained before Judge Schrader. But I think any time that you have a failed substitution, you're going to create some ill will with the trial judge. Essentially, what you are saying to the court is, I don't think you can be a fair judge. And then when the substitution request is denied, you say, well, I want you to be fair on this case. Just ignore that last comment I made about you. And I think that's another factor that is relevant to whether or not the Pierce presumption should apply. I don't think there's any case that's directly on point. I think this court is almost going to be asked to look at all the facts and circumstances that are relevant to the issue of whether the Pierce presumption should apply. And I think if the court does that here, it will determine that the Pierce presumption should apply.
I don't quite understand that argument, counsel, why the substitution issue has anything to do with the underlying principles of the Pierce presumption.
I argue that it is a factor that would impact on the possibility that a trial judge may have vindictive feelings towards a defendant.
Well, let's back up a minute. What is the underpinning or underpinnings of the Pierce presumption? What is it trying to guard against?
It is trying to guard against defendants being punished for successfully appealing their cases.
And so what does the substitution issue have to do with that?
I would simply argue that it's that in this particular case, it is one fact that you would look at in trying to determine whether or not Judge Schrader was going to act fairly and impartially, and whether or not the Pierce presumption should apply. Does that answer your question?
It does not, but maybe it can't be answered.
It may not be able to be answered, but like I say, I think Pierce does apply in this case. If Pierce applies, then the next step would be to look at what happened at resentencing. Judge Schrader essentially cited two facts which he suggested were new objective evidence which would justify the harsher sentence. We've already discussed the higher medical bills. There was also some discussion regarding the worsened condition of the victim. I think at the first sentencing, the appearance was that the victim may have some permanent disability, and that was yet to be determined. At the second sentencing, before Judge Schrader, the victim came in and said that I may never walk again, but she also said that her doctors were hopeful.
I want to ask you, suppose that these facts do not rise to a presumption of vindictiveness, then you have to show actual vindictiveness.
That's correct.
What does that mean? I'm looking at Church, and it says, defendants, to premise an increased sentence after a successful appeal on a defendant's continual denial of responsibility comes far too close to punishing the defendant for exercising his right to appeal. Does vindictiveness mean nastiness by the judge, or does it mean that the effect of the sentence is to punish the defendant for exercising his right to appeal? Because I hear you and read your brief to mean that there is no change. The victim was severely injured before. At that time, it was unclear whether she would or would not ever be able to get out of a wheelchair. She had medical damages of, what was it, $30,000. But it was clear that they were going to increase. She was not done with her treatments, right?
Right.
So I read your brief to say none of this is new. It's not a new event. It's not a new condition of the defendant. That what you do is you have a continuation of what has already been considered. And under Church, that is not permitted.
Correct. And Church is day by day the sex offender continued his denial.
Right. So my question to you is, of course, it helps you to have a presumption.
Correct.
But if you don't have a presumption, then what do you have to show, vindictiveness? Do you have to show that the judge is vindictive, mean-spirited, nasty, has something in for your client, or do you just have to show that the judge did not consider the appropriate factors, that is, that there were no new factors?
And I think that gets to be the concern here. I think that...
Which is it?
I think the defendant would have to show that the judge was, in fact, being nasty. And how is a defendant ever going to show that? You know, the judge isn't going to...
So it's a personal kind of thing with the judge, rather than objectively, did the judge consider new factors?
That would be my position.
All right.
I see my time's up.
Ask Mr. Weinstein if that's his position. Warren D. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General, appearing to represent the state of Wisconsin.
Correct, Your Honor.
Counsel?
To start with that, I would say what he has to show is that the judge is actually trying to punish him for exercising his appellate rights.
Okay.
And that's the evil we're trying to address.
All right. And if the judge does not use appropriate factors, let's just assume, like in Church, here, had the judge said, you have not accepted responsibility, you're still saying you weren't liable and that you weren't responsible and that you didn't take treatment. And under Church, that this doesn't constitute objective information of identifiable conduct on the part of the defendant subsequent to the original sentencing, right?
Right.
Okay. So let us just suppose it's exactly the same as Church, except you've got a new judge.
Right.
Right.
In my view, there's no presumption.
That's right. Okay, I understand that. But
and therefore, the fact that the judge in Church said, the reason I'm doing this is because
right.
here's how I view your
right.
attitude, which is different than the first judge, no,
right.
unquestionably, but it's also clearly relevant factors for sentencing.
So if it
there's no proof of actual vindictiveness.
Okay, if this were a Church case, well, the only difference between Church and this case would be that there's another judge on sentencing. The result would be different, in your opinion?
In my view, yes.
Be different?
Yes.
Even though the judge emphasizes in sentencing factors that are not objective information of identifiable
but
conduct.
But that requirement only exists because of the presumption. In the absence of the presumption, the only thing that the judge is limited to is factors relevant to sentencing. So the question is, in my view, did the judge in Church apply factors that were relevant in sentencing? And the answer to that question is yes. However, in Church, there was a presumption, and so that was not enough to overcome the presumption. Without the presumption, I think there's no showing of actual vindictiveness in Church, and because the court relied on relevant factors, none of which had anything to do with the appeal, the result has to be different in Church. Now, I don't suggest that Church is wrongly decided. I think the factors, all of the factors that were present in Church, almost none of them are present here. It's a different judge. There was no appeal. There is information, albeit similar to other information. It was expanded, which is exactly the situation in Alabama versus Smith. We have a plea, and then we have a trial. Well, all the evidence that went in at trial was available at the time of the plea. So the only thing we have is expanded information. That's what we have here. So, in my view, if there is a presumption, there's still sufficient information because of the victim impact and because of the increased information about the impact of the crime on the victim to justify overcoming the presumption. After all, what are we looking for here? We're looking for, did the judge try to punish the defendant for, in this case, a motion, or is the judge relying on something other than the fact that the defendant sought to vindicate what he viewed as an error in the first proceeding? And
Counselor,
here it's clear that he did.
Counselor, could you respond to opposing counsel's argument that the second sentencing judge used the first sentence as a minimum rather than exercising his discretion on the overall factors, please?
Well, I don't see any evidence that he used it as a, quote, minimum. There's evidence that he was aware of it. But, as in Texas versus McCullough, the judge was aware of what the jury assessed in the first trial, and in fact said, candidly, I would have given him a more increased sentence than the jury did. And that's one of the reasons that I'm giving him an increased sentence now. And the Supreme Court relies on that as one of the factors to mitigate or to indicate that there's no reasonable likelihood of vindictive behavior here such that the presumption never arises. So mere knowledge of what the previous sentence is, in my view, doesn't even rise to the level of warranting a presumption, because in many of the Supreme Court cases, the judges were aware of what the previous sentence was, and in fact, they would have to be, because how else could the defendant make the argument that this is an increased sentence?
But, Counsel, what about opposing counsel's argument that the sentencing judge said, well, circumstances are a lot more severe right now at the time of this sentencing than they were at the other? Why would he have said that if he were not using the other sentence as a minimum?
Well, I would suggest he said that because he was aware of the Pierce requirement.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
He was aware that if he increased the sentence, he had to state the reasons why on the record. That's why. And it's the cautious thing to do, because the U.S. Supreme Court has not said definitively that a new judge is a situation in which there's no presumption. I think that's probably the right answer. I know that's what the majority of courts that have considered the issue directly have decided, but it's not been decided in Wisconsin, and it's not been decided definitively by the U.S. Supreme Court. So the safe thing to do, seems to me, if you're a judge and you're going to increase a sentence on resentencing, is to say why. And that's exactly what Judge Schroeder did.
If we hold for the state in this case, then are we saying to the trial judges that the sentence should be proportionate to the medical expenses and proportionate to the degree of harm, whether in wheelchair 6 months, 2 years, or forever?
I don't think so. I don't think any more than saying that the judge can appropriately consider the impact on the victim in the first instance would say that. Maybe I didn't make myself clear.
No,
if this court says, and certainly the Court of Appeals has said, that it's appropriate for, and I think the Supreme Court has at least inferentially said, that it's appropriate for a sentencing judge to consider the impact of the crime on a victim. I don't think that says to the judge, you know, you should set up a chart in which $70,000 equals 4 years. And I don't think it would any more in this case than it would in initial sentencing.
Suppose the victim had been disabled to begin with. Would that change the sentence?
Well, it would change the impact on the victim, and I would think it would depend on the calculus of the individual sentencing judge, which is the way we do it. I mean, maybe it would have. Maybe it wouldn't have. It depends on how the judge views it in all the circumstances. But that's why we give discretion to the sentencing judges. And I think, in the absence of vindictiveness, the only thing the court should look for is whether or not, though an appellate court should look for, is whether or not the court considered factors that were appropriate in sentencing. Now, there is the, if the defendant can show actual vindictiveness, that's a different matter. But in the absence of any evidence of vindictiveness and in the absence of a presumption, it seems to me it is exactly like a first sentencing. Did the judge consider appropriate sentencing, which translates in this case to, is the impact on the victim appropriate for consideration for sentencing? And I think the answer to that question is yes. How it impacts in all of that depends on the individual judge and how that judge sees all of the other factors, including the impact on the victim.
If there is no presumption of vindictiveness, and if there's no showing of active or actual vindictiveness, then the resentencing judge arguably starts with a clean slate. Yet it appears to me that in this case, the resentencing judge did not start with a clean slate, arguably, because it was in relation to the sentence already imposed, with terms, comparative terms, harsher or, you know, more injured than originally thought.
Isn't that inherent in any resentencing? I mean, to say that it's a resentencing means there has been a first sentence. So in any case in which there's a resentencing, the judge, in all probability, will be aware of what the first sentence was.
Yes, but then it seems like we are engaging in a legal fiction and pretending as though it's a clean slate, but with one eye open and one eye closed, because we know it isn't a clean slate.
Well, the problem, though, with the other side of that coin, which is pretending that it's not, that amounts to double jeopardy prohibits an increased sentence, and that proposition has been clearly and emphatically rejected by the United States Supreme Court. So it seems to me that you've got the choice of, as you put it, doing it with one eye open or doing it with both eyes open and violating the Constitution.
Well, that's a pretty tough choice, especially for a Wednesday morning. You talk about the converse, and something also strikes me, the converse here. In this case, it appears the only thing that changed was the worsening condition of the victim. And the worsening condition of the victim justified an increase of a couple of years of initial confinement. I mean, shouldn't the converse also have and justify the same result? Should defense attorneys now on resentencing, based on the precedent that you're arguing for, say, look, Judge, this victim wasn't in a wheelchair hardly as long at all as initially thought. And the medical bills they thought were going to be much greater. You know, there was a miraculous recovery. So isn't that a foundation for advancing a lesser sentence? And wouldn't one necessarily follow?
Sure, and I see nothing in the law that prevents that, even now. On a resentencing, for a defendant to come in and say, well, when Judge Kluka gave the sentence of 3 years, we thought the victim was going to be permanently disabled, and the victim's back in the back of the courtroom doing handsprings. I don't think 3 years is justified. I don't see anything wrong with that argument. Now, maybe the judge buys it, and maybe the judge doesn't buy it, but I think it's certainly available to the defendant to argue that, just like they always do argue, I'm sure. I've been a real good person since I got convicted of this crime, and you ought to take that into account in sentencing. Well, yeah, maybe yes and maybe no. Depends on how the judge views that and a lot of other factors. But certainly that's available to the defense. So, yeah, I think it cuts
available
both ways.
Available is one thing. How it plays out is another.
Well, that's always the case, right?
Your point is well taken.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's available. So, exactly. The one other thing, particularly in addition to the different judge, and many of the cases, many of the courts that have considered it have said, that's all, that's enough. We don't have to go any further. There are some that have said, nah, that doesn't matter at all. And there are also some that say, well, that alone is not enough. We'll look at that and other factors. So what are the other factors in this case? First of all, this was not an appeal. This was a motion for a new trial. Now, that's something that the U.S. Supreme Court emphasized in Texas versus McCullough. And it seems to me that the fact that this wasn't the same judge that granted the motion for a new trial cuts in favor of no presumption, not in favor of a presumption, because why on earth would a new judge think, if Judge Kluka, someone who he's got some confidence in probably from sitting on the same bench, thought there was an error here? Well, there probably was an error here, and yeah, it needs to be redone. The second thing is, this wasn't a judicial error. And the purpose, one of the purposes of the vindictive presumption is because the judge will have a stake in the case because the judge thought that the judge did it right and somebody else is telling him, no, you didn't do it right. Well, Judge Kluka didn't do anything wrong here. The prosecutor did. And it did it at a point where Judge Kluka had no control at all over the proceedings. This was argument on sentencing. And all of a sudden, the prosecutor says, oh, this wasn't a very good deal because we found out about these other convictions. Well, at that point, Judge Kluka's tied in. That's pretty clearly an end run around the plea bargain. So I don't know that Judge Kluka had any choice at all but to grant, and the state didn't oppose the motion because it was so clearly an error. So why on earth would Judge Schrader have a stake in that kind of an error? I don't think he did. The problem is, and I think I agree with Mr. Brehm, the appropriate standard here is for the right, whether or not there is a presumption, is there a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness in this kind of a situation? And I think even if you don't want to say that a new judge by itself is enough, the fact that we have a new judge, the fact that we have no appeal, the fact that we have prosecutorial error, not judicial error, all very strongly, it seems to me, indicate there's no need for a presumption in this case. I don't read Church as saying anything to the contrary. In my view, the Church case was primarily concerned with some problems in Wisconsin law that made it appear that Wisconsin wasn't following the same standard as North Carolina versus Pearson, the United States Supreme Court. The facts in Church, when you actually get down to what happens given the presumption applies, are quite different than the facts in this case. And I don't think there's anything in Church that would say, gee, when you take the facts in this case and apply the Pierce and its progeny's development of the presumption of judicial vindictiveness, we conclude in this case there's no need for a presumption. I don't think there's anything in Church that says that. In my view, Church is fine, and Church cleared up the law here. So it puts us, what it did do is it made the Court of Appeals decision in this case totally irrelevant because they relied on their earlier Church case in affirming. So we didn't have a very good basis for defending the Court of Appeals decision.
So how would you write this opinion, Mr. Weinstein?
Well, first of all, I guess the breach of the plea agreement, which in my view, the defendant got everything he bargained for here. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that what the state reserved was the right to argue, and that's exactly what the prosecutor did. He never indicated that he thought anything other than jail time as a condition of probation was appropriate. He argued for rather restrictive conditions, which included not being able to go into restaurants that serve alcohol. I've never seen that before, but I mean, I suppose it's possible that it's more common than I think. But it's certainly unusual, I think, and he had to justify that, and he did. And I don't see that there's anything wrong with that. He recommended probation, he recommended extended supervision, and he argued in favor of it, and that's what the bargain was. He argued that, or they bargained for a dismissal, which he got. So, I mean, I think there was nothing wrong with the plea bargain. So I would not spend much time. If I were writing an opinion, I wouldn't spend much time on that issue. If I were writing the decision, I would find that a different judge is sufficient to lower the reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness such that there's no need for a presumption. That seems to me to be where the U.S. Supreme Court is going, and that's where the majority of the lower cases have gone. So that's the way I would resolve it. If there are any other questions, I'll be happy to entertain them. Otherwise,
I don't find anything on pages 6 and 7 of your brief where he states, Mr. Gidkowski states his recommendation to indicate anything that's a violation of the plea agreement, and that would make ineffective assistance of counsel, because there was no objection. Isn't that the issue?
I'm sorry, which part of page 6 and 7?
Well, you quote
that's his entire argument.
Yeah, and you don't think there's anything in here that...
I don't think there's anything in there that violates the plea bargain, no. I mean, one of the cases that Mr. Naderhorst relies on is, I can't remember the name of it, but the case in which the prosecutor kind of adopted as his own a PSI recommendation that was quite harsh. That didn't happen here. He did recite it, but he didn't say, boy, I think this is right. I wish I'd have thought of that earlier, or something that would indicate that he's doing anything other than repeating what the victim had already said. And I might add that the victim did not appear at the first sentencing. So the victim did personally appear at the second. I'm not sure that that's a big thing, but it is a difference.
Did the prosecutor breach the plea agreement the first time around?
Oh, yes, definitely.
All right. Did Judge Schrader know about all of that?
I don't know. There's nothing in the record that specifically says he did. He did know that it was a resentencing. He did know what Judge Kluka's original sentence was, apparently. He never referred to it specifically, but I agree with Mr. Brehm that the way you read his comments means that he was aware of the original sentencing and presumably what that sentence was. But so far as I know, if I were to guess, I would guess that he knew, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that one way or the other.
I'm trying to find the right language, but this isn't very good, but once the genie is out of the bottle, in the sense of breaching the plea agreement, how can you put it back in the bottle, even when the prosecutor says, hypothetically, nothing objectionable the second time around?
Well, I suppose I understand what you're saying. It seems to me that there are two responses to that. One is that even at the first sentencing, the fact that the man had been convicted of prior drug-related driving offenses was known to the sentencing judge. So the fact that the second judge knew it also is not really a change, and really doesn't have anything to do with the plea agreement itself. The second thing is that if we want to adopt that view, it seems to me that we have to remove resentencing as an available remedy for breach of a plea agreement. And I haven't seen any case on any level that indicates that that's appropriate. It's always mentioned as one of the two available remedies, resentencing or specific enforcement of the original plea agreement. And since we don't bind, unlike the federal system, we don't bind, or bind is perhaps too strong a term, because I don't think they bind, federal judges aren't bound by the plea agreement, but they do have to offer the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea, which we don't have here. And since we have that difference, it seems to me that limiting it to specific enforcement, given the structure of our law, is probably not the right way to go on that, because that pretty much amounts to the ability to set aside the plea agreement or to withdraw a plea if the judge isn't going to follow the plea agreement.
Well, this is from the denial of the post-conviction motion, and the court is talking here. And who is Mr. Chirafisi? Is he an assistant DA?
I'm sorry?
Who is Mr. Chirafisi? He's an assistant DA?
Yes.
Who initially handled this case?
No, he was the one who handled it on resentencing.
Okay. And the courts, I think he did it originally on sentencing.
Oh, did he?
Yes,
okay.
Because the lawyer here is Mr. Gengowski, as I understand
it. Oh, you're right. You're right.
So they're talking about the first sentencing. This is with Judge Schroeder.
And
the court is saying that I like Mr. Chirafisi. I think he's a good lawyer. I think he won a case here not but a few weeks ago, very effectively, I might add. So he's a good lawyer and everything. I don't want to downgrade him. As was said, the facts weren't known, and that's part of the problem with the plea bargaining process. It was a preposterous agreement. And so now to come back and say, well, this is the second time the DA hasn't gone along. Well, the reason the DA doesn't appear to be going along to some observers is the DA is coming up short when there are things to say that are positive. And I think there were things said that were positive. And to the extent that there weren't, as I said before, the DA does have to make some kind of pitch. Maybe less in this case, but I'll tell you, judges are unpredictable. I'm sure Miss Rush, she must be defense counsel.
Well.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry.
Who's Miss Rush?
Another AD.
Another AD. Over here, will tell you there were lots of times she walked out of here watching people get hammered when she thought they were going to get treated lightly, and other days when she watched people get very light sentences in her estimation when she thought they shouldn't. So judges here and everywhere can be unpredictable. So the DA has to make a reasonable presentation recommending to the court an appropriate disposition. And Mr. Gengowski, he's the assistant DA, statements along the line were reasonable. He talks about the seriousness of the offense. He amplified a little bit of the victim's statement, as was done in the Williams case, but in a different way. He amplified from important information to the court some of what the victims had to say. And then he says that the judges should not automatically accept plea agreements, and I agree with that. And then they ought to be given credit for independence that they have, and that Judge Kluka demonstrated that. All these comments having been made, I will tell you I do not feel there is an issue about Mr. Moyer's conduct. Mr. Moyer was defense counsel. And I might parenthetically state, although I don't need to, that Mr. Moyer enjoys a very enviable reputation for handling his cases very, very well and very aggressively on behalf of the defendants, and I saw nothing in this case here that could even suggest an ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's right. It's an ineffective assistance claim because counsel didn't object.
Because he didn't object to the
DA's
statements, right. I don't see there's any issue worthy of taking of testimony with respect to the conduct. So he didn't
right.
even have a hearing.
That's right. That's right. Because he didn't, and I've talked it like this is an actual issue on whether or not the plea agreement was breached, and that's the way the Court of Appeals addressed it. That's not really the issue, but the reason that the trial judge didn't think that there was a hearing was warranted was because he didn't believe there was a plea agreement, and the case has been argued on those grounds all the way up, and that's fine. I mean, if you disagree, then it has to go back for a Mockner hearing.
Counsel, the trial judge also said, and this case, by the way, is significantly different than what it was when it was before Judge Kluka. And he went on to say, after commenting on the victim's injuries, that's a monstrous increase in the enormity of this crime from how it appeared to be before Judge Kluka. We were previously discussing the Church case, and Church at 704 says, the circuit court evidently treated this resentencing as an opportunity to revisit the original sentence based upon updated information and argument. Under these circumstances, we conclude that the Pierce presumption is triggered. Why shouldn't the presumption of vindictiveness apply here when you have the resentencing judge so clearly referring to the predicate sentence, that is, revisiting the original sentence based upon updated information and argument?
Well, I guess the short answer is because I think when you don't have the same judge, when you didn't have an appeal, and when the error that precipitated the whole thing wasn't a judicial error, there's not a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness.
I know that's your argument,
yeah.
And you've certainly set that forth in your brief and
the
here.
Problem I
but
have
how does
with
that square with the Church language?
Right. The problem I have with that language in Church is that absence of vindictiveness, that's exactly what this court has said is appropriate at resentencing. And that wasn't directly an issue in the briefs in this case, but in State versus...
Wasn't that language in Church designed to take this case out of the Martin Grabarczyk line of cases, which is the sentence immediately preceding it?
That's the way I read it. In my view, the Church decision is a decision which addresses a line of cases, starting with Lombard and going through a few others, Stubb and Dick and a few others of these, which appeared to say that if you had a resentencing in certain situations, we didn't really look at whether or not there was judicial vindictiveness. And Church says, no, that's not right. What the Supreme Court has said in Pierce, and in the cases following Pierce, is that if there's an increased sentence and the circumstances of the case are such that there's a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness, then there's a presumption. And if there's a presumption, what we look for in the record is a reason, a non-vindictive reason for an increase in the sentence. And I think that's important because what we're really trying to do here is prevent the judge, any judge, from punishing the defendant for an appeal. And it seems to me, so long as the reason clearly indicates that the judge is not punishing the defendant for an appeal but relying on something else that is appropriate for sentencing, then that should be sufficient to rebut the presumption, even though it's my position that there is no presumption. So.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Your time is up. We will hear from Mr. Brain for rebuttal.
I'll try not to jump around too much here, but I would like to start out by talking a little about the best practice in this type of situation. It probably would be a better thing to do in a case like this to keep the information about what the prior sentence was from the second sentencing judge. I think in this particular case, Judge Schrader had a lot of information about what had happened in the case. I was just taking a look at the record, and the motion for a resentencing was filed on December 4th of, I don't even remember the year, but the actual resentencing took place at least a month after that, I believe. So Judge Schrader would have had an opportunity to review basically the core underpinnings of what the defendant's position was and why he felt he was entitled to a resentencing.
I find that an unusual argument, counsel. Don't defense attorneys in that situation usually like to argue that the resentencing judge should simply reimpose the original sentence or come in under it?
That is an interesting question, because you would think that both the state and the defense would have wanted to use the sentence of Judge Kluka as a benchmark.
As a cap.
Well, the defense wanted it as a cap, and then the state may not have wanted that.
I mean, the original sentence exceeded the negotiated recommendation to begin with.
Significantly.
So from the defense's perspective, you're going to argue first for the original sentencing recommendation, which is probation with jail time as a condition. But absent that, you're going to argue that the judge should impose not more than the original 3 years and maybe less.
I think strategically, maybe in this particular case, the defense would have wanted to avoid dealing with that three-year sentence structure to avoid any suggestion that it had any merit.
Well, in any case, the defense is going to be motivated not to get more than the original sentence.
Yes, but I don't think that they would have wanted to discuss too much the fact that Judge Kluka had given 3 years in this case when they were trying to suggest that something way less than that was appropriate. With regard to the Williams issue, the first issue, I think the most important language from that case says that the state cannot make end runs around plea agreements. The state cannot induce a defendant to plead pursuant to a plea agreement and then turn around and suggest to the court that some more onerous sentence would be appropriate. And I would argue that at the resentencing, something along that line took place. The state, in its remarks, suggested that probation and jail time was appropriate, but also in the remarks, there's not one positive statement made about the defendant at any point.
Does the law require that?
I would take the position that it does, in that the state has an obligation to provide an argument in support of its position. And in this particular case, they were arguing for probation, and I think it's completely at odds with their position if they are not giving the court any indication that probation is going to be successful in this case.
That would be a really new principle of law, I think, for us to say that whenever the negotiated recommendation is for probation, the prosecutor must say something nice about the defendant. Otherwise, it's a breach of the plea agreement.
Well, I would take the position that the state would have to give some indication to the court that probation is going to be a viable option in this case. And I don't know how the state can portray that when the state comes with nothing but negative information the entire time.
Well, he said that it'd be probation, but that a one-year jail term was absolutely necessary since the defendant had an apparent drinking problem that he did not fully recognize and therefore was not going to be able to overcome.
But I think objectively, when you look at what the prosecutor said, the argument was one more likely to be made when you're arguing for prison. When you
the judge said it was a preposterous plea agreement and that the DA knew it and he did the best he could considering he had a preposterous plea agreement.
I believe that's
an objection, isn't it, really? that that's what the judge thought, it was preposterous, thought that the DA thought it was preposterous, and the DA therefore should not defend it very well.
Well, and if the DA doesn't want to defend it well, there's other options available. Certainly, other things could have been done here that probably would have been more appropriate and more above board.
Like what?
If the state didn't want to support this plea agreement in the first place, what it should have done is turned to the defendant and said, you know what? This plea agreement is not appropriate. We're all going to start from square one. You should be allowed to withdraw your plea. If you don't want to withdraw your plea, you are put on notice that we are no longer going to be bound by this plea agreement. That certainly could have been something the state did in this case. Obviously, it was not done.
So what you really want is an opportunity to plead again.
I'm not suggesting that the defendant in this case would want another opportunity to plead.
What is it you want, then?
I would want the court to institute the sentence that was originally handed down by Judge Kluka. I think that is probably...
Another resentencing?
Well, in the alternative, I requested a resentencing.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Green. Thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for your argument this morning on yet another plea agreement case and another resentencing case. The students should remain here if they're staying for a discussion with Justice Bradley. We will be joined by other students who are here this morning. We are in recess until 1:30.